Welcome to the Philosophy Cast, where we take complicated philosophical topics and break them down for everyone to understand so that we can gain new perspectives on the world. I'm your host, Alexander Chotai. In the recent election, two of the accusations most commonly bandied about were those of fascism, for those on the right, and Marxism, for those on the left. But what do these terms actually mean, given just how frequently used these terms are in our political lexicon nowadays? It's important to understand both the history of these terms and what we take them to mean. To understand that, you need to go back to Europe. At the turn of the 19th century, Europe began to look radically different than before. Let's start by thinking about Marxism and the historical conditions under which it emerged. At the turn of the 19th century, technology began to develop very fast in a short period of time. Within less than 100 years, the Industrial Revolution completely changed the continent, both socially and physically. Industrialization had many good aspects. The productivity it brought is the reason we have so many things today. The availability of things in general is something we have the Industrial Revolution to thank for. And it would be simply inaccurate to focus only on the positives of industrialization. Poor working conditions, pitiful wages, child labor, and immeasurable pollution were all consequences. Marx turned his attention to the political, cultural, and economic strife, all interconnected within the Industrial Revolution. Among other things, Marx focused on the apparent loss of pleasure in creation. With factories and wage labor, we created so we could survive. No longer was it just about the joy of creation. Marx felt that the proper use of labor is doing something you enjoy, not what your boss wants of you. But Marx thought this had been lost. To him, the Industrial Revolution, and more specifically capitalism, were to blame for the disappearance of something so crucial as leisure time. Let's connect this to today. Did you notice how, when the pandemic hit, you had so much time on your hands that you went a little crazy? Marx would say that's because you're so used to not having any time at all to just stop and breathe. The capitalist system doesn't allow for what he sees as normal human desire for some time off every once in a while. For some, even more so after the Industrial Revolution, everything you do involves maximizing your productivity just so you can have enough money to feed your family. Marx also found the widening wealth gap alarming, not to mention the increasingly poor conditions of workers, the exploitation of workers at the hands of the rich and powerful. Some also relate the conditions around Marx's lifetime to our lives during the pandemic, blaming the lack of socialized healthcare and a serious wealth gap as the reason the bad pandemic grew so much worse than we anticipated. I mean, take a look at this headline from Vice.com. Capitalism's response to coronavirus makes a strong case for socialism. Clearly, people are starting to consider a system that combats inequality a little more fiercely than the one we have in place right now. But not everyone responded this way to COVID, just like not all thinkers responded to the Industrial Revolution in the same way. Let's go back to our study of Marxism and fascism in their original forms for a moment. Unlike Marx, some other thinkers didn't see widespread inequality and a loss of luxury time as the greatest problem that arose from the Industrial Revolution, but were rather alarmed by their view that the significance of what it meant to belong to a nation was diminishing. Workers whose conditions of life were suddenly dictated by their employers were no longer able to be a part of the strong nations they so desired. A seemingly apparent loss in an older, greater glory prompted many to criticize the new, modern world and to call for its restructuring in order to reinvoke a sense of nationalism in the populace. They proposed a society centered around a strong state and a strong national identity, an Italy that Italians can be proud of, a Spain that Spaniards can be proud of. These things were of utmost importance for these ideologies. They must be. They saw life as a constant struggle. It was said that they disdained an easy life. Life is about struggling and improving, and so the ideal life is a life lived for the nation, a life best spent continually improving the nation, both in terms of what you can and cannot see with your own eyes, is the ideal life to live. These thinkers, who opposed the revolution and sought a sort of crossroads between free markets and a totally planned economy, were the fascists. Some, even today, take issue with the government closing society and halting life as we know it. And unlike the people I mentioned earlier, they have a different gripe under the lockdown. That is, the lockdown part of it. These people take issue with a stop-everything approach to the coronavirus. They were opposed to closing the doors of all the world's normal functions. This, among other issues, leads to a diminishing sense of nationhood. Some think that America, in particular, has lost its luster as a beacon of freedom, because it seems like everywhere you turn, there's rules being forced, which just shouldn't be. They are less concerned with what the pandemic has revealed when it comes to inequality, and are more worried about what will become of the country after this virus passes. Now, I wouldn't necessarily label these people as fascists, just as I necessarily wouldn't label everyone reconsidering their thoughts on equality during the pandemic a Marxist. Maybe some of these people in these two camps are Marxists or fascists, but they were probably looking at these worldviews before the pandemic hit. Maybe the pandemic and subsequent lockdown made them more passionate about their views. Maybe the lockdown made some people reconsider the ideas that they already held. It is certainly possible. But my goal here isn't to label either side as Marxist or fascist. It's to make the analogy between the Industrial Revolution and the coronavirus pandemic. Both are events which either are already in, or most likely will make it into history textbooks, and naturally, people are going to disagree on how we should respond to these events. With both events, you can see certain opposing sides developing, which are broadly bound together through certain shared sentiments. But it's not black and white. It never has been, and it never will be. So while different responses to the pandemic might share some similarities to these worldviews, they're never going to be the exact same. My goal is to show how events affected philosophy, and a great comparison when talking about the ideological reactions to the Industrial Revolution is the pandemic happening now. Who knows? Maybe we might get entirely new ideologies and worldviews from how different people respond to COVID-19. What my goal here isn't is to oversimplify history. What I'm trying to show you is that these ideologies are pretty fascinating, specifically because of their relevance in the modern day. As always, the truth resists simplicity, and there are many reasons for the rise of these two ideologies. I chose the Industrial Revolution as a baseline because, well, the notion that these ideologies became prevalent in the 19th century rather than the 14th happened for a reason, made sense to me. And if the ideologies we're discussing happened at the turn of the 19th century, it only makes sense to turn to the biggest event at the time, the mechanization of everything from everyday goods to warfare. I wanted to hear more about these two complicated ideologies, both of which are definitely relevant today, to understand their origins and histories. I've invited Professor Jeffrey Upton from Seton Hall University to help explain it to us. Professor Upton is an assistant professor of political science, as well as the pre-law advisor for the College of Arts and Sciences at Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey. He has a PhD in political science from the University of California, Berkeley, a Juris Doctor degree from Harvard Law School, and a Bachelor Arts degree, magna cum laude, from Harvard College. He has practiced law in both the public and private sectors for several years, and also has professional experience in both journalism and publishing. I am happy to introduce Professor Jeffrey Upton. So, Mr. Upton, how would you briefly describe the philosophy of Marxism and fascism?
Well, I think there are certainly two different things, Marxism and fascism. Marxism, you know, if you go back to Karl Marx himself, was writing in the 19th century and writing in response to the failure, in his view, of the French Revolution and the failure of the nation states of Europe to really provide the equality and the freedom that they claimed that they wanted to accomplish through revolutions like the French Revolution. And in Marx's observation of what was going on in Europe in the 1800s, he saw great suffering and great inequality, especially when he looked at what was happening with industrialization and the Industrial Revolution causing such extreme suffering on the part of factory workers. And in his observation, the capitalist class who owned the factories were becoming relatively wealthy while there was all this great suffering going on. And he saw that as a great injustice. And he thought that the governments that were claiming equality, like the French Revolution, claiming equality and fraternity among the people and liberty, he thought that was kind of a lie. And it was a good step in the right direction, but it was falling far short of true equality and true freedom, which he thought would only come when people, everyday people, ordinary people, were not being exploited by their capitalist bosses. So, you know, at the root of Marxism, I think, is the idea that Marx first elaborated, which is that freedom and equality can't be only a matter of politics, but also require a kind of economic justice, economic equality. So I'd say all of the people who identify as Marxists today or who come out of a tradition of Marxism share at some level an appreciation or a concern for issues of economic justice and looking at politics, society, household, economy as all connected, and seeing that you have to consider economic relations and class relations in any analysis of the proper role of government. So that's a bit on Marxism. And then as far as, you know, fascism in many ways, I guess, is older than Marxism, goes back to ancient history, and really in some ways in the 20th century got combined with Marxism in some people's view because of certain extreme political movements that adopted aspects of Marxist philosophy and Marxist terminology, such as the class structure, class warfare, class consciousness, etc., but tied that to the more state-centered reforms that they were seeking, or more state power. And so fascism itself is, you might say, more of what some call a thin ideology. I think this is something we may have talked about in our class over the summer, a thin ideology in the sense that it's almost more of a tactic or of a strategy for having a strong central power that rules in a less collaborative, less democratic fashion. And so in a sense, combining fascism and Marxism, they're kind of opposites, because you could argue that Marxism is ultimately a very democratic philosophy, in that the idea of Marxism is that all people should be treated equally, all people should have an equal ability to be free and to control their economic and social and political life. Whereas fascism tends to look at it more from the perspective of a very strong central power that, in a sense, dominates the state with a kind of dictatorship. So although in the 20th century, fascism and Marxism were combined in a lot of people's minds, in theory, I would say they're actually quite opposite.
Yeah. And that sort of goes into the next question I had, which was how and where the state was involved in Marxism and fascism, and how they disregard the role of the state.
Right. So, I mean, for Marx himself, many people are maybe familiar with the idea from Marx that ultimately the state would wither away. Marx and Engels writing that. And what that implied or suggested was that eventually, after a communist revolution that ultimately would make class struggle unnecessary, that would end the exploitation of the workers, Marx and Engels thought that there would really be no need for the kind of state that we have in the modern world, where the state is an agent of power and violence and force. It doesn't mean that Marx thought there would be no need for organization, and there might still be a need for a kind of a government organization, but that there would be no need for a state to order people around and rule with power, because he thought that the state essentially only exists, or mainly exists, to enforce the will of the factory-owning class, the bourgeoisie. And he thought that the state, in that sense, would no longer be necessary once the people rose up and took back control of the economy and society. That's kind of a logical conclusion. If the state exists in order to serve the interests of the capital-owning, factory-owning class, and to keep the workers in their place, essentially, well, if the workers revolt and take over the economy, then there's no need for that kind of state anymore. So I think that's what Marx was suggesting when he said ultimately, eventually, after the communist revolution, the state would wither away. Again, it doesn't mean there wouldn't be a need for organization, but that kind of organization would be done through people's committees and so forth, like the way a co-op supermarket might be run or something, as opposed to a state with a monopoly on violence. For fascism, as I was suggesting earlier, it's much the opposite. Fascism which is, you know, especially if we think of it in terms of the 20th century fascist movements in Europe, that was very much about a very strong authoritarian state that controlled every aspect of society. So I think if you look at the role of the state, that's a perfect way of seeing the strong difference between fascism and Marxism, where for Marxism, the state would ultimately disappear. For certain views that can be characterized as fascist, the state is the most important thing there is. And the state is ultimately responsible for structuring and organizing the society and the economy.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that sort of goes into the next point I had, which is that some people disagree about the proper role of the state in Marxist philosophy. You know, some people think that you need to have a strong state with a lot of power at the top, such as in the USSR. But some believe that a Marxist society is only truly possible in a limited state, or even anarchy without a state at all. So I was kind of wondering what you thought about the sort of debates that occur when it comes to the proper role of the state, these ideologies, what that discourse can reveal to us about the ideologies themselves.
Well, I mean, I would just, to go back to your what you just said, I would just clarify that I don't think that a Marxist view is one that wants anarchy. Anarchy is an idea of, usually thought of as kind of disorder, right? A kind of lack of any structure of society. And the Marxist view, although there are many different understandings of Marxism, I don't think hardly any of them would say they see themselves as anarchists. Marxist view would tend to suggest that society should be organized from the bottom up by the people themselves in a more free, democratic fashion. So again, it could be organization through committees, through volunteer efforts, through more truly democratic elections, through cooperative organizations, whereas fascism suggests an organization from the top down, from a central committee or one person in a more dictatorial form of fascism. So I don't think either of these ideologies could be really described as anarchy or as supporting an anarchy. And I think, you know, for those who say that, I think this was also part of your question, for those who say that Marxism requires a kind of fascism or requires a kind of top-down organization, that again is something that most Marxists would probably disagree with, at least if they are being faithful to what Marx himself had written and argued for, that the way that Marxism was imposed, in a sense, in the 20th century in places like the former Soviet Union and to some extent China, they would say that's not really faithful to Marx's original ideas and to his theories, that the way it was imposed was in a kind of artificial top-down way. And although there were, you know, some people would certainly defend some of the policies that Russia or China imposed in the way of providing for basic needs, minimizing great inequality, etc., it was also combined with often great infringements on individual rights and freedoms and liberties that would not be acceptable to a true Marxist, in the sense that, again, Marx thought that the equality and the communal organization of society should not be enforced from the top, but should come out of a mass movement of the vast majority of working people coming together and uniting to kind of create a better future for themselves. It's not in his idea, and for, again, for kind of a more traditional Marxist, it's not supposed to be enforced on the people by a central committee or something. It's supposed to come from the grassroots, as we would say today, from the people themselves seizing control and seizing power. So for those who are skeptical of Marxism because of the way it was tied to the violence of the 20th century, I think many would want to separate those and say that was not true Marxism. That was a kind of twisted version of it that did not really represent the democratic ideals of freedom and liberty and equality that would ultimately be desirable in a real Marxist society.
I see. And so more on the topic of specific countries, one thing I noticed when researching fascism was the seeming variety in the things different fascist and fascist-like movement supported. So, for example, Franco's regime in Spain was a bit different than fascist Italy, with Franco being very concerned about religion, Mussolini being more concerned with making the nation of Italy a stronger world power. And so I was wondering how you would explain the existence of different flavors of fascism.
Yeah, I think to explain that would be helpful to go back to the terminology that I mentioned earlier, this idea of thin and thick ideologies. The idea of thin and thick ideologies, again, is this idea that a thin ideology is more like a political method or a style, whereas a thick ideology has more of a substance to it, more of a real content. And if you think of fascism as a thin ideology, then it makes sense that you'll see various contents connected with it, right? Because if you look at the examples that you gave of different countries in Europe, or certainly if you compare Europe with other places around the world that might also be said to have been fascist, you may see great differences in the content or even in the style of what they were advocating, but you'll see some similarities in the sense of the focus on the nationalistic rhetoric, on a strong central power. So if fascism is a thin ideology, then it makes sense that it can be paired with different kinds of content. Whereas something like Marxism, I would argue, is sort of a thicker ideology, which would mean that although there may be regional differences, ultimately a true form of Marxism would probably look fairly similar in different societies if it were to emerge, because it is that kind of a more substantive, thicker ideology. So I think that's one way of explaining why you see such differences across different examples of fascist governments.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, you know, what we discussed earlier in the podcast section was that fascism is very concerned with the nation. The nation it's being implemented in is obviously going to differ, because what's important to one nation might not be as important to another nation. So, you know, to go back to like Franco, Spain was very concerned with Catholicism, like it's a Catholic religion. And so maybe Franco would have been more concerned with that rhetoric as opposed to a nation like Italy, where Mussolini was appealing to the Italian desire to become stronger.
Yeah, and then to take that a step further, to go back to Marxism, ultimately, Marxism is itself kind of an anti-nationalist philosophy, in that Marx himself argued that the true communist revolution of the people would have to be worldwide, would have to be global. And ultimately, the nation state itself would kind of wither away, right? That we would no longer have these different national identities so much, because people would realize that ultimately they have more in common with each other than they differ. That workers in Spain and workers in Italy share the same fundamental goals and interests, in contrast to the interests of the bourgeoisie, the owners of capital. So in a true Marxist vision, it is again kind of the opposite of fascism, where the nationalism that defines fascism is not consistent with Marxism at all. That Marxism is really an anti-nationalist movement, because it calls for connections to be made across national boundaries and these unified movements of workers around the world. You know, of course, the famous last sentence of the Communist Manifesto, "Workers of the world unite." And so the Communist Manifesto itself is, in a sense, an anti-nationalist document.
Right. The final thing I wanted to discuss is that people tend to throw out the word fascism a lot nowadays, as they do Marxism. And I was wondering if you could talk to us about the relevance these terms have to our political landscape today, and if you think the role of the state in particular is still relevant to these discussions.
Well, there is a lot of discussion, you know, at least there has been over the last few years in the United States, and will probably continue in connection with understanding President Trump and the threat that some people thought and maybe still think that President Trump poses to democracy. And so we saw, I think, a reawakening of interest in the idea of fascism and the history of fascism, because there was a lot of concern over the last few years that the United States was going down that road, that Trump in particular had some of the makings of a fascist dictator, fascist leader. There were things along that were characteristic of Trump's political style and content that made people worry about this, including his nationalistic rhetoric, his sort of embrace of the military as both symbol and also a tool possibly to use for certain domestic ends, his kind of celebration of, some would say, cruelty or violence or nastiness. So, you know, and then of course, this kind of power of the leader, the way that the Republican Party became very much centered around this idea or this vision of Trump as the leader. So there were a lot of ways in which people were concerned, and rightfully so, that democracy could lead to fascism in our current times, and that we were seeing it not only with Trump, but in other countries around the world, from Eastern Europe to the Philippines and elsewhere, that we had in South America, that you had these leaders who were coming out of democratic countries, but seeming to act in these problematic, anti-democratic, proto-fascist ways. So I think that certainly was, and I don't think that just because Trump has lost the election, I don't think that those concerns will disappear. Many people have commented along the lines, political commentators have commented and argued that Trump was kind of a weak attempt at being a fascist, but that his time in office showed the vulnerabilities of the United States or any democracy really to a would-be fascist type leader. And so there, you know, there's been concern that the next person who would try to act in the way Trump has might be more successful than Trump was in doing that. So I think this concern about fascism and fascist strategies and styles of leadership will certainly continue. Marxism, I guess we haven't heard quite as much about lately. There's been certainly the concern about socialism that's become a big topic in American politics with the ascendance of certain figures on the left who identify with democratic socialism and probably would say they support some Marxist ideas and maybe respect Marx himself. So I do think there is, you know, there's a legacy of Marxism and the debates around Marxism that is still very much alive, although, of course, even those on the far left, such as Bernie Sanders or AOC, even they don't go as far as a true Marxist would in calling for violent revolution to overthrow the capitalist class. So I think although we're seeing a revival of interest in some of Marx's ideas, I don't think Marxism itself is really on the table in the same way that something more moderate, like what some call democratic socialism, currently is.
Yeah, and I guess I would just be wondering is, Marx and fascist philosophers would obviously have different conceptions of the state. And I was wondering if you personally think that those different conceptions of the state are still being discussed in current political lexicon.
Just to go back to where we started the conversation, for a true Marxist, you know, looking back to Marx's own writings, the idea would be that the state ultimately would not be necessary, that the state as an agent of top-down force is something that he did not think long-term, really long-term, would have a place in a free society. That we can have organization, we can have structure, but we don't need a violent apparatus of the government enforcing class interests. And I don't think that view gets talked about or thought about very much. And you know, you're seeing, in a way, I guess you're seeing a little bit of that discussion come up with the issue about abolishing the police that has come up in connection with Black Lives Matter movement. So there may be some discussion around the role of the state in that respect, but overall, I would say there's not so much thought being given to this admittedly more abstract question of what role would the state play in a world in which there really were no violent conflicts between nations and in which the people were kind of in control of their economic destiny. There may also be some opportunities for discussions in that vein in connection with the climate crisis and thoughts about how the world is going to have to change economically and politically in relation to the climate crisis. But I think, you know, we don't really talk too much these days about the withering away of the state. It still seems very theoretical and very abstract. So I think we're still very much connected to and living in a world that assumes the importance and the longevity of the traditional centralized nationalistic nation state model that is prone to the possibility of fascism as a leadership style.
So I suppose what you would be saying is that the things that Marxist and fascist debate have to bring to the table in terms of the state are more implicit as opposed to being explicitly talked about on the debate stage.
Like I said, I think fascism is more discussed openly as something to be worried about than is Marxism in a truly Marxist sense. You know, the ways that Marx is brought up and referred to are often a more of a caricature these days than in a true sense of economic theory. And so as far as the role of the state in particular goes, I think the fascist thin ideology of a nationalistic, powerful leader at the head of a dominant state is far more, fortunately, probably is far more of a concern than the more utopian, democratic, frankly, ideal of a world without powerful, separate states that go to war with each other and fight against each other. You know, in a truly Marxist vision of the world, you would basically have something like a world without borders, a world without conflict among different nations, because you would have a world that put basically that put workers first, that put fundamental human needs first. And there is a possibility that the climate crisis, the environmental crisis, will force some steps in that direction. But you know, I wouldn't expect that to happen anytime soon.
All right. Well, thank you for your input. It was great having you on. And I think our audience will really appreciate the insight you were able to provide for us today.
My pleasure. It was great speaking with you.
Likewise. Thanks for listening to the Philosophy Cast. We hope you learned something new or gained a deeper understanding of the world around you. Live to know what you think, and you can tell us your thoughts at thephilosophycast@gmail.com or at philosophycast.com. This has been Alexander Chotai, and I'll see you on the next episode of Philosophy Cast.